Hello and welcome back to More Than Tracy Turnblad, the podcast about fat representation in entertainment and media. My name is Abby Rose Morris, and today I am here with my co-host Maya, who you might know if you are on Patreon or if you've listened to their interview episode, and we have a few updates for you on how the podcast is going to go forward. Say hi, Maya.
Hello, hello.
Hello. So, we have just been doing interviews pretty much on the main feed for the past, since this podcast began. And we have so much fun doing our little Patreon episodes where we watch a movie and talk about it. So, we've decided to make the main feed a little more of like a smorgasbord of podcast formats, is how I'll put it. So, we're going to mainly be doing this season of maybe of fall, because I think technically we're still in season 3 and I don't want to make it season 4 because that sounds like too big of a number for me. But anyway, going forward, we are going to be doing a lot more of this chatting about existing media with fat representation and other hot fat topics.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So today we are going to be starting that off with you with a discussion about The Whale, and we're going to be joined by BJ Colangelo for that. But before that, I want to kind of reintroduce you guys to Maya and just give you a little more info about them, since you're going to be hearing a lot of them on the podcast moving forward. So this is where I put you on the spot and say, tell us about yourself.
Heck yeah. I've been ready my whole life for this.
Yes.
So my name is Maya. I am originally from Kansas. I very recently moved to Brooklyn, New York, and I am so incredibly happy to be here. I am extremely passionate about fat representation, about fat positivity. I am a fat kid at heart. I am an actor. I really love musical theater, straight plays, TV, movies, pretty much anything. I would be willing to do anything to perform for anyone at this point.
Call them.
For real, call me. I am also a photographer, which is just, it's like a hobby, but also something that I'm pretty serious about. I think you can be serious about more than one thing, so.
Absolutely.
I'll say that I'm also serious about photography, and I'm very creative. I love clay making. I recently got into wheel throwing.
Whoa.
Love it. It's very fun. I really get into flow in wheel thrown, mm-hmm. and it's really great to be able to focus on something. And I am also very passionate about mental health and destigmatizing mental illness. And I, for one, am very mentally ill, so I'm excited to talk about that and just be open and honest without compromising my well-being.
Hell yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And since we ask everybody on the podcast this question, and you'll hear me ask it to BJ in a few minutes, what is one fat character you love and one fat character or piece of representation that you hate?
Ooh. Okay, so I really love Ursula. I won't lie. I've just been obsessed with Ursula since I was very, very little. I don't think I knew when I was a kid that Ursula was based off a drag queen. But now that I know that, that Ursula is divine, it makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
Just because of, the overwhelming femininity and how she feels herself. She's just so incredibly confident. And you can really, tell that she thinks she's so sexy. And I love that.
Mm-hmm.
I really love seeing that. And I have never felt that personally, but I love it for other people.
I feel the same exact way.
Every time I see a person feeling really sexy, especially a fat person, I'm like, yes.
Oh my gosh. When fat people do burlesque, I'm like, oh my god, you're amazing. Thank you. I could never.
For real. I love that for you. Not me, but I love it for you. Yes.
Yes. And what's one you hate?
Okay.
Least favorite.
There's worst. A lot that I hate.
Worst. You can't say The Whale because we're gonna get into it.
Okay, yeah, true. I'm gonna say Mr. Dursley from Harry Potter.
That's a good one.
It is one. Certainly one of my least favorite, if not my least favorite. He is a pretty flat character. He has a couple attributes, mostly that he's an asshole and, like, you see him eating and stuff. And he also has other fat, also mean and awful, like, siblings and stuff. And it just is very, like, I mean, we all know J.K. Rowling is, like, a little fucked up with the stuff that she did. Just a little bit. so yeah, I know that he always was someone who just, like, made me feel bad about existing, and I didn't like his son either, Dudley.
Yeah.
But I think Dudley was, like, maybe slightly more of a, like, rounded character. Like, he wasn't as one-dimensional.
Yeah, he does get a little more, like, almost redemption, not quite, but you see, like, a little more layers of him in the end, I think.
Yes.
But with Uncle Vernon, he's just, like, Roald Dahl-style evil fat villain.
For real, yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, and Roald Dahl, I would put in the camp of some of the worst fat phobia for me.
Yep.
Like, those children's books where they need an evil one-dimensional villain and they make it bad, that's just so deeply harmful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's so rude.
Indeed. Ugh. So let's get into the whale with BJ. And I want to preface this with, you may have seen on social media, this movie, The Whale, is getting some healthy debate going on about it.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it's based on a play by Samuel D. Hunter, and there's a new movie of it directed by Darren Aronofsky, who directed Black Swan and a whole bunch of other movies that we'll talk about in the episode.
Mm.
And basically, The Whale has kind of lit up some discourse in the past week or two on social media, particularly fat social media. So because of that, we have taken this opportunity to read the play and discuss it with BJ.
Oof.
So without further ado, let's talk about The Whale. So welcome, BJ.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm so excited. I feel like I met you like the first week the podcast happened on the internet. And I was like, I need to get her on. And now here we are. Like,
the TikTok algorithm knew. Like, the TikTok algorithm knew that I needed to listen to your podcast.
Yes. And tell us about your own podcast and what you do.
Sure. So I co-host the podcast This Ends at Prom with my wife, Harmony. It is a podcast about coming of age films catered to or about teen girls. And the original idea was that my wife is transgender, and a lot of these seminal films that I grew up watching at sleepovers, she completely missed. And it's to go back and see if they actually are any good or if I just have rose-colored nostalgia glasses. But it has since grown into a dissection of the art form as well as a vehicle to heal all of our inner teenage girls.
That's beautiful. I love that so much. What a great concept for a podcast. It really is. And such a great title too.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it was born out of boring quarantine, needing something to do. And I do want to clarify that teen girl is its own separate gender from the world. Anybody can have an inner teen girl. It does not matter how you were assigned at birth.
Absolutely. So let's talk about body size. And does that show up in your work at all, either in your like film analysis and journalism or podcasting?
It comes up in both, especially in This Ends at Prom. We talk a lot about fat representation in teen movies or the lack of it, or the way that fat characters are treated in these movies, even as side characters, and how that can have an impact on you when you're, you know, very young and vulnerable and learning from what you see on TV and how to treat people. But then I also do deal with it a lot in my day-to-day life as a film analyst, because the way I try to explain things to people when they try to say, oh, it's not that deep, or oh, it's just a movie, is that if a movie like Jaws can make an entire generation, multiple generations of people terrified to go into the water, how can you say that we are not picking up messaging from the things that we're consuming? And what are we learning about people? And as a fat person, I am acutely aware of the way that entertainment has impacted my day-to-day life, either by the names that I've been called, the characters I've been compared to, and that's why something like The Whale is especially so egregious.
Word.
It's so funny that you bring up Jaws because I saw it for the first time like 2 days ago.
Did you get to see it in the theater? Oh,
I did. Yeah, it was crazy. I actually hate seeing movies in IMAX, which I forgot until I was there because it makes me like dizzy.
Oh, but yeah.
I really enjoyed the movie. It was cool.
Yeah, it's a solid movie. It's a great movie if you like monologues from dads.
That's such a good tagline for it. It's so incredibly accurate. So accurate. Yeah. Okay. So before we get into the whale, I just want to ask you, do you have any favorite fat characters or least favorite fat characters or just fat representations that have impacted you particularly?
Ooh, goodness. So I am somebody who worships at the altar of John Waters, and most people assume that means I'm going to talk about Tracy Turnblad, who I have played multiple times in my life, but my answer is actually Edith Massey. I'm obsessed with Edith Massey and the way that John Waters consistently was like, I do not care if your body is quote unquote considered ugly or grotesque. I'm going to put you in whatever costume you feel comfortable in. And that often meant like titties out and, you know, full body rolls on display, you know, imperfect teeth, crooked makeup. And I love that she was treated as a glorious person in all of her movies, even when she's a villain. So I love Edith Massey a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot. And then another fat character I think that is really seminal to me is Miss Piggy. I know she's not an actual person, but Miss Piggy means a lot to me, especially as somebody who is married to a slender person. It makes me feel very seen, and I love that Miss Piggy takes no crap from anybody, and I think that that's an attitude I've adopted over the years because of her influence.
As you should, honestly. What an influential queen. And I think she would be so honored by that as well.
I would hope so. I always tell people that Frank Oz is the original drag queen because he's been playing Miss Piggy for God knows how long at this point.
True. So let's get into The Whale. So for anybody who does not know, The Whale is a play that came out. It was developed at the Denver Center Theater Company's 2011 New Play Summit, had its world premiere at the Ricketson Theater in Denver, Colorado in January 2012. And then it was presented off-Broadway at Playwrights Horizons on October 12, 2012. So those were the first few productions of it. It's very loved in the theater community and has had a lot of praise and glowing reviews. It's won many, many, many awards, including the Lucille Lortel Award, the Drama Desk Special Award for Significant Contribution to Theater, a GLAAD Media Award, Drama League Award. There's many, many awards. And I'm going to now ask Maya to read this summary that I'm about to put in the chat.
You know, I'm a little bit grateful that I didn't go to theater school now because I had no awareness of this play before the movie. And I'm sure that I would have had some awareness of it if I had gone to theater school. This is just shocking to me that this is such a like pillar of great playwriting. It's wild.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead and read the summary so everyone can hear why.
All right. On the outskirts of Mormon country, Idaho, a 600-pound recluse hides away in his apartment and slowly eats himself to death. Desperate to reconnect with his long-estranged daughter, he reaches out to her, only to find a viciously sharp-tongued and wildly unhappy teen, big-hearted and fiercely funny. The Whale tells a story of a man's last chance at redemption and of finding beauty in the most unexpected places.
Big-hearted.
I cannot believe. I can't.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I think this episode's going to be a lot of these kinds of reactions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So now you have the general gist of The Whale. We're going to kind of summarize it plot point by plot point as we go through the script today. I will say, in terms of background, this play, like as you mentioned about going to theater school, I went to acting school and I was a musical theater major, but I took a lot of classes with the acting majors. because our programs had a lot of overlap. And I also just kind of shoved myself in all the extra acting classes I could. And particularly the acting majors at my school were obsessed with this play. And my school was really like new play focused, very acting focused. In the musical theater department. So we had a lot of classes where they would emphasize like learning about new playwrights like Samuel D. Hunter. And this play was constantly used as an example of an incredible play. And I knew like they had done a production of it at a prominent theater near my school that people were like really praising a lot. And that had happened like just before I got to school. And I remember having friends who like did monologues of the teenage daughter and like really wanted to play her. I did not know what it was about for the first 3 years of school. I just thought, oh, The Whale, that's a good play. I didn't know anything about it. And then senior year, I read it because I was looking for monologues. And oh boy, it didn't have any monologues for any of the people I was looking for. Including myself. But anyway, then I sort of put it away. And then during quarantine, I started this like play reading group where we would like just read a play every couple weeks and discuss it. And this ended up being one of them. And upon reread, it had made me uncomfortable the first time. The second time it made me even more uncomfortable. But also I will say that both times I read it, I felt pressure to give it credit where credit was due, if mm-hmm. it's due anywhere, as we'll determine in the course of this discussion. Like, because it was so unilaterally praised, I felt that I needed to also praise it in some way and say like, yeah, it makes me uncomfortable, but like, maybe this is the real experience of someone his size. I'm not his size, so I don't know. Or like, maybe this is really technically good writing and hits all the structural beats of a good play. Like, you know what I mean? So yeah. I have now read it a third time and I'm ready to roast it.
I'm ready to light this play on fire.
I am so glad that I was able to dodge this when I was in acting school, because I'm a little bit older than you. So I graduated the year that this came out, but I absolutely would have had to read this had I been in school a little bit longer, because my school was also very new play focused, but mm-hmm. I managed to escape this. And this is a very recent read for me.
Happy for you.
And I have many feelings as well. And why did we give it awards? I don't know. We'll get there.
We will definitely get there. Let's begin the synopsis.
Okay.
So basically it starts off with this guy, Charlie, in his apartment, who is 600 pounds. And I think it's notable that in the first stage direction, they mention that within arm's reach of the couch are a small computer desk on rollers with a laptop on top, a large pile of papers, a walker, a claw for reaching, and a whole universe of full, empty, and half-empty food containers, donuts, candy bars, fried chicken, burgers, 2-liter soda bottles, etc. Little effort has been made to clean up trash or organize. That, I feel, is significant. Mm-hmm. Because for a play whose goal is ostensibly to give this character humanity, like, you start off by being like, look at this disgusting slob who eats junk food. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It just seems like, both a portrait of disability and specifically fat disability, indicating like, but it's not necessarily accurate, and they mm-hmm. still adhere to all stereotypes about large fat people.
Yes.
And I think that is a problem, because this is not like challenging anything that people may have thought for a long time.
Yes. And also just like, there's food wrappers all around him, but he has a claw and he could throw them out, and he uses the claw throughout the
exactly
thing. And he at least tries to get up. It's not like he's lazy. He seems to want to move around. He just can't. So yep. I just think there's a lot of shock value.
Yes. And I think what's most troubling is that if we were to take out the aspect of him being a super fat person and swap that in with somebody who is struggling because they are a hoarder or have some other similar way of coping, then people would immediately have that empathy. But the way yeah, that mm-hmm. fat people are depicted when they are living in these sort of circumstances is not empathy. It's disgust immediately. And to not take that into consideration, I think, is so poorly judged and just very ignorant.
Yep. So the first scene is like, it's established that he's like kind of an English teacher online, voice only, like he doesn't show his Zoom video. Mm-hmm. And he like has these essays of his students on various literature, works of literature. And then scene two, after that very short, like sort of prologue, is him in front of the computer masturbating to gay porn. And it's then like... he almost has a heart attack while doing that.
So that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They just have to establish his job, and then they're like, and boom, gay porn, heart attack. Let's go. Yes.
And actually, Samuel Hunter made a comment on that in this. So he says, visually, I just had this idea in the beginning of this man almost attached to this couch, like a part of the furniture, who at first glance is almost inhuman. And that's why at the beginning of the play, I put him in these startling physical situations, masturbating to pornography and things like that. So hopefully the audience will have this journey where they are putting him at arm's length and they really don't want to connect with him. But then throughout the process of the play, he becomes more and more human.
Oh, buddy.
I'm not sure if a fat person masturbating humanizes them or not. I keep thinking of the first scene of Fat Girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're so right. Yeah.
Because it's almost like, because it is so human, it's like...
right. A human thing? Whoa.
Yeah.
And I know that it's a mild spoiler for ahead, but they mention about his body like, oh, can you believe he can even find it? The introduction of him being in this scene in this way, it plays into also a trope that we see quite often. And usually it's done for comedy, where people have heart attacks and die when they are on their partners, or horror, like in the case of something like Gerald's Game, where he's incredibly fit but has a heart attack. And it's very interesting to hear this quote where he's basically admitting he's trying to dehumanize this character. And at the same time, you know that putting the image in an audience's mind of a fat person of this size being a sexual being is supposed to elicit a response, because people cannot fathom the fact that fat people still are sexual beings. And I say this as a fat person who is a hypersexual being. So I have a lot of feelings about this being our introduction to him outside of the prologue.
That's a really valuable opinion to hear, because like I'm very like not sexual, and I haven't talked to many like hypersexual fat people about the way that they feel about these things. So I feel like it's important to hear that.
Oh yeah,
for sure. Because sometimes I'm like, oh, am I offended by this because I'm such a prude, or is it because genuinely because it's offensive?
Oh yeah, I am so offended by this scene, and I am somebody who, this is, you know, full admittance, cards on the table. I have done sex work before. People have watched me do this action myself on camera, and so I understand the visuals of like what this tells to an audience, and it's either, this is a grotesque, almost sideshow attraction, or this is something meant to be fetishized. Yeah. But we obviously know, based on the setting of his living situation, that we are not meant to fetishize this. We are not meant to find this titillating. We're supposed to be disgusted.
Right.
Right. And then, of course, he almost has a heart attack.
Stunning.
And then this Mormon missionary comes to the door, sort of catches him in the act, because the porn is still playing. Mm-hmm. Also, like, it should be noted, there's a lot of themes of him being queer in this. This is really so much about being gay. Mm-hmm. And we're definitely going to get more into that. But obviously, Mormon missionary finds out right away. And he's basically saying, like, let me help you. Let me call an ambulance. And instead of, you know, having him do that, Charlie recites from memory this essay on Moby Dick, which is very, very bad. He refuses the ambulance. He refuses to go to the hospital. At first, I was like, yeah, no kidding. I'm sure that they would just be awful to him at the hospital.
This is something that happens page 5. So it's a little bit farther down in this part of the play, but he says, I don't go to hospitals, like, very matter-of-factly. And when I first read that, I was like, is this person gonna like talk about how larger fat people are like not gonna get the help that they need from, you know, emergency services? But then I felt that by the time that I finished the play, it was clear that there was a different meaning to I refuse medical care. And that, that will come back up because I don't want to like spoil it, but you know.
Yes. So it's kind of a mystery and we're like, why won't he go to the hospital? Right. And then instead of that, he calls his friend who's a nurse and he asks the missionary to stay with him basically because he might be about to die.
Mm-hmm.
And the missionary asks, what is this thing you had me read about Moby Dick? Sorry, my bad. I don't think Charlie was reciting it from memory. I guess there was a piece of paper with the physical essay on it.
Right. It seems to be like an important essay to Charlie. And at this point in the play, that is for reasons unknown to the viewer. Exactly. So Elder Thomas is kind of playing the part of the viewer and asking like what is going on. And it's not clear.
Right.
It's not clear yet.
Right. And he says, why did you want me to read that to you? And Charlie says, because I thought I was dying and I wanted to hear it one last time.
Mm-hmm.
So then his nurse friend arrives. His nurse friend.
Mm.
He says he doesn't have health insurance and that's why he didn't go to the hospital. And she's like, just being so horribly mean to him.
So Charlie's friend is named Liz. Just so everyone knows, Liz is a bitch. I hate her.
Liz is a cunt.
That's what I wrote in my notes like 50 times, but I didn't know if I wanted to say it or not. So Liz is a cunt. 100%.
Sorry.
No, like I just needed someone to rip off the Band-Aid for me, you know?
Fair.
But yeah.
Always happy to rip off the cunt Band-Aid.
A cunty little Band-Aid.
That would be the episode title if we didn't have to title it The Whale.
Yeah.
I have weirdly mixed feelings about Liz, and I will unpack this. My mixed feelings on her is that I have an affinity for harsh friends. Like, I love harsh friend characters who are able to communicate with you in a way that no one else can. A really wonderful example of this is a character named Solly in the movie Angel, which is a high school student by day, like Hollywood hooker by night kind of movie. So it's already playing in some very weird territory. But Susan Tyrell, who is like a masterful actor, plays this character where everything she says is so mean, but you know that it's with love.
Mm.
And I feel like this is who this character is supposed to read as, is this type of friend who is mean and harsh and says things like, I will fully admit, my wife and I joke all the time that like, I'll be like, oh, I'm a fat piece of shit. And she's like, but you're my fat piece of shit, because that's a way that I reclaim my own body. And, you know, if somebody yells that to me on the street, I'm putting that in my pocket. That's mine now. But Liz does not fulfill that role for me. She just becomes mean-spirited. And it's so disappointing because the potential is there for her to be a rich and wonderful kind of character that is able to have this like self-deprecating banter, but it completely falls flat.
I totally see that.
Yes. She's doing it all out of care for him, but she's so mean in the process. I think that Liz is Neil LaBute mean.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah. So Neil LaBute, for anyone who doesn't know, is a playwright who is famous for writing extremely horrible, particularly misogynistic characters. He wrote this one play called Reasons to Be Pretty and also Fat Pig, which is about a fat character. And basically the characters in this play say insanely horrible stuff, so much so that people are like, at what point are you platforming these opinions, Neil LaBute?
Exactly.
That's how I feel. Yep.
Yes. Yes, and that's how I feel about this. Yet it has such a different response than people had to other Neil LaBute plays, or that people have to them now. So it's like Neil LaBute has aged poorly, although maybe some of his plays, like Fat Pig, got a similar response to The Whale when they were first produced.
Mm.
But now people seem to have really turned on Neil LaBute. And to be fair, he's had some personal accusations and things that are excellent reason to turn on him. But people have these criticisms of his work now that they don't seem to have for The Whale, and I don't understand why.
Yeah.
Anyway, Liz takes his blood pressure. It's 237/135, which means he basically already should be dead. I looked up what is a high blood pressure reading, and I think it's anything over 140 and anything over 185, like, of the top number,
mm-hmm.
is like, you're gonna die. And his is 237 over 135 when normal is 120 over 80. So to that, when she tells him that, he says, sorry.
Yep.
And I just thought that was interesting.
He apologizes so much in this play. Right.
Yep. This is where that starts. Like, it wasn't too much of a problem when I had first heard it, and then I kept seeing it repeated, and I was like, oh boy, this is brutal to watch. Yeah.
I picked up on it from the first one, because it's like, is that cliche of like, I'm so sorry for existing because I am so fat, like, I hate myself. You know what I mean?
Yep.
But the reason he is sorry is because people make him feel like shit all the time.
Yep.
Like, Liz is saying these really mean things to him. Everybody, the world is horrible to fat people. And so, why wouldn't he apologize? Because it seems like from people's reactions to him, he's causing them pain just by existing. So of course he's going to say sorry. And then they say, what are you sorry for? Stop apologizing. And I feel like I've had that happen to me too, in less of a fat context, more of just a messing stuff up context, where people are like, why did you mess this up? And I'm like, I'm sorry. And they're like, don't apologize. I'm like, you just yelled at me. What do you want me to do? You know?
That does, I feel like that specifically, the constant apologizing to multiple different characters, to everyone essentially, is just like, that does hurt in a particular way, because it reminds me of the first way that I reacted to like anti-fatness as like a little fat kid.
Yeah.
Because that was the way I reacted. Like, I legitimately felt that I was causing people pain and distress by the way that I looked. And that made me feel like shit, obviously, because I was like, I don't want to make people feel bad. Like, I'm so sorry that I am disadvantaging people by existing.
It's totally a natural reaction.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's also an intentional decision to have him play this apologetic character, because by establishing him as somebody who is apologizing or even feeling ashamed, as audiences, it immediately puts you on their side of, oh, see, he's aware of what a burden he is on everybody. Now I feel for you. And
yep, exactly.
It's just really disgusting.
Yep.
Yeah, it helps people pity him. Especially, I think this play also has the narrative that, like, yes, he's in control of his weight, but his weight is a product of tragic circumstance, which we'll get into later. It's like the emotional eating piece makes people forgive him a little bit too, which we will get into. Anyway, Elder Thomas and Liz have a conversation when Charlie goes to the bathroom, where Elder Thomas says, why is he, how did he get, and Liz says, to be that fat, he ate. And then she goes on to say, he kept eating for years and years and years. He didn't accidentally gain 300 pounds. He didn't just wake up one morning like, oh, wow, I'm a huge, fat, disgusting monster. How did that happen?
That's my least favorite line in the entire play. So that's my take.
I feel like that line just speaks for itself. Like, you can just leave that there and walk away. Yeah, like, what do you say about that? It's pretty matter of fact that it's really shitty.
Yep.
Anyway, so then Liz tells Elder Thomas that the church has caused Charlie a lot of pain because it killed his boyfriend.
Reveal.
She also calls him in this monologue that fat, disgusting, gay thing, which is fucking hard. Like, that is the one I wrote down as being like, how do you say this about anybody you consider a person, let alone a friend?
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally thing.
Oh my God.
And using disgusting next to fat and next to gay.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
that fat, disgusting, gay thing is the only thing I have anymore that even resembles a friend. That's the sentence.
Yes.
Even like resembles.
I should make that my new TikTok bio. That disgusting gay thing and just leave it there.
You should
and see what happens.
Once, if it's true that they didn't change the script at all for the movie, everyone's gonna know what you're talking about pretty soon.
We should start a movement for everyone to change their bio. So cute.
Anyway, Liz keeps saying, you're dying, you have congestive heart failure, go to the hospital. He says, no, basically he knows he's going to die and he's just going to keep working. And he says, I'm sorry, I know I'm an awful person, I know I'm sorry.
Woo! Woo, yeah!
He's also literally not an awful person, as we'll get into in the rest of this, but... Yeah. Anyway,
Liz, after some convincing, finally got, Elder Thomas to leave. So that's great. And Charlie and Liz are together again alone and mm-hmm. more convincing to go to the hospital ensues. Charlie is still, refusing and then tells Liz that he wants to, call Ellie. And we don't know who Ellie is yet. But, oh my god, the rest of this scene is basically just Liz, like, poking him and prodding him and trying to get him to go to the hospital. And then she eventually tries to put some makeup on him at the end of the scene for some fun.
Which he seems very uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I feel really uncomfortable. And she goes to leave because I guess she's insulted by him asserting himself literally at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he apologizes and says, I was having fun. I like it when you do this. I'm sorry. It's fun. Just really telling.
Mm-hmm. Boy, oh boy. Mm-hmm.
This is
It's also like, does she assume that since he's gay, he wants to wear makeup? Like,
I'm not 100% on how I'm supposed to take this scene because,
yeah,
obviously we learn how the two of them are connected later. And part of me mm-hmm. is like, maybe this is something that they used to do that was very fun before things have gotten to this situation. But
yes,
if I remember correctly, because I do not have the script in front of me, she also gives him food. During this scene before the makeup.
After he apologizes and says actually he was having fun, the next line is, did you bring food? So,
mm-hmm. Nice.
She brings him a bucket of chicken and he eats it.
I think.
And she puts the makeup on.
I think the visual and the specific choice of it being fried chicken is also something to point out because... Mm-hmm. Fried chicken is one of those foods that has, I think, a very visceral reaction to people, either when they're reading it or when they're seeing it, because yep. it's yeah. food that has to be eaten with the hands, first off. So automatically,
yes. True.
We're removing a little bit of humanity because we're not using tools, so we're eating the way that animals do. And it's right. fried, oh, which means that it is going to be messy. It's going to be juicy and greasy, and mm-hmm. that is such a, like, when you're writing a play, you get to make these choices. And, like, there is a reason that she is choosing to give him this and not say, I don't know, what's a weird health thing? Like, yogurt. Like, it's the yeah. fact that it's fried chicken is very, very intentional. And it's not even, like, chicken nuggets. It is fried chicken. Hold mm-hmm. this bone with your hand. Eat like an animal so I can gawk at you.
Yep. Right. And I think it's also important to mention that fried chicken specifically has been very racialized.
Absolutely.
For a long time. And that is part of the connection to less than human kind of eating practices. And of course, mm-hmm. we know that there's a lot of connection between anti-fatness and racism. So there's yes. some fun business there.
Yeah, I was wondering about that choice of it being that food, especially because I'm pretty sure this character is white and always has been played by white people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Charlie goes to sleep with much difficulty, like, because he's in such pain. And he recites the essay to himself to help him fall asleep. And then his daughter comes over. So I guess he did call her.
Mm-hmm. And this is when it's, when is it made clear that Ellie is his daughter? Because I don't know when that
I think happens. In the conversation with Liz.
Okay.
I could be wrong, though. But it's at some point, it's revealed mm-hmm. between when we said before and now. Mm-hmm. So Ellie is an interesting character, meaning she's not interesting. She's fucking boring and she's awful.
She is an angry teen girl written by somebody who has never been or probably met an angry teen girl.
For real. Angry teen girls are not like this. This to me is an angry teen boy, to be totally honest.
That's kind of how I feel about it. There is a lot of that going on. And part of me feels like it's, I understand that when we're working in theater or film, shorthand is important so that the final product becomes accessible and easy to understand for the masses. Right. I get that. Mm-hmm. But also the way that she communicates, the way that she acts, the way she expresses her anger, it really does feel incredibly masculine. And that's not to say that obviously people who are assigned female birth cannot express themselves in masculine ways. But to me, this fully feels like somebody who wrote this character who does not know what that type of anger feels like and did not consult with anybody on how to express that anger in a way that is authentic to this character.
Yeah, because someone... Like, it is true that someone who is socialized as a woman, like, has different ways of expressing their anger, and that we are taught to express our anger in certain ways or not express our anger. And I think that it did feel very disjointed, her behavior and who she is supposed to be by, you know, other descriptors. I had real trouble, like, empathizing with her. For a lot of it.
She feels like a very flat character to me. Mm.
Yes, she's very one-dimensional to me. And it's a shame because obviously when we get to the film, it will be Sadie Sink, who I think is a remarkably talented performer. Mm-hmm. And I'm very curious to see how she's going to handle this material that's really not giving her much to do other than call everything the Arsler.
Yep.
Word. Basically... The first thing she says is, like, how much do you weigh? And does this mean I'm going to get fat? And is just kind of interrogating him. She asked him why doesn't he go to the hospital. He says he doesn't have health insurance. He's trying to ask her about herself. She's kind of not having it. And she reveals that she's been suspended from school for basically posting on, like, this blog where she just is mean to people.
It feels like he watched Mean Girls, learned what a burn book was, and then went, oh, but if it's a blog.
Burn blog.
Yeah, that's what it feels like to me.
But she's like, basically, she's failing school. She might not graduate. She calls him disgusting. Mm-hmm. She keeps saying that it smells bad in his apartment and that he smells bad, which is interesting, too, that like the idea of him smelling bad when it's like, obviously, he can make it to the bathroom. So like...
Yeah.
Is she just being a bitch or does he not shower or like what?
I have very strong feelings about this. One of the most viral TikToks that I have is specifically about the association with bad smell and fat people and how fat people are assumed to smell bad. If some if there is a fart in an elevator and there's a fat person, everyone assumes it was the fat person. And is very upsetting. But this moment to me is where you can tell just the ignorance of how fat people exist happens, because if we are showing that he is capable of being able to get up and go to the restroom, if he has a claw that is allowing him to reach for certain things, we know that there is some ability to be able to keep himself relatively hygienic. I don't know what else word to use, but we also have like the garbage that's thrown everywhere. So like it's inconsistent. Like, are we supposed to view him as somebody who has completely given up on himself totally? Or are we supposed to view him as somebody who is capable and wanting to do things? Like, it's inconsistent. And
yeah,
that's what makes it more frustrating. And that's where I think the hand is shown of, I don't actually know how fat people exist. And this is purely spectacle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. I do think he is supposed to not give a shit about anything. Like, I think he's very obviously depressed.
They're painting him as depressed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very classically depressed. Anyway, so Charlie convinces Ellie that he'll write all of her essays for school and help her pass if she spends time with him. And he promises that she can have all the money he has in the bank, which he reveals is $120,000. So... turns out he was lying about not having money.
Yep.
He could buy insurance. He could afford some kind of medical help.
Mm-hmm.
But he chooses not to because he is killing himself, because he's given up on himself.
Yes.
And there you have the thing about this play that I think is what makes it irredeemable in my personal view.
Yeah, this was, I feel like this was when I was like, okay, so this is when it's revealed that it's not that he's like unable to go to the doctor, or in my case, that he was like traumatized by going to the doctor, that he specifically was avoiding it, in an organized effort to die. And I just want to say, other than it's just dehumanizing and weird, it also feels very inaccurate to me personally. Just as someone who like has dealt with that kind of depression, it's just not common for suicide to be a long game. That's just not accurate.
Yes, I was going to say the same thing. There are much more efficient ways to die if you want to die.
And you don't even know if that's going to kill you. You don't even know.
Exactly.
So something that I've been seeing recently in the wake of the film having its premiere and therefore critics seeing it is I have seen some critics try to claim that this is a story about somebody with binge eating disorder. And I have a lot of feelings about that because I don't believe that is accurate. And I think that that is also extremely harmful and dangerous to perpetuate about the actual binge eating disorder, because we learn so early on that this is a deliberate choice that Charlie is making as a form of self-harm. This is not a condition or a disorder that he has developed that can be treated and he's avoiding it. Like, this is an active participant in this. Whereas binge eating disorder, by and large, is something that becomes a compulsion. And by labeling this as binge eating disorder is giving, I think, everyone involved way too much credit. And it's also weird. I don't like pathologizing when something's not in the text. I think that is, it can be very dangerous. It's a very, very tricky line to cross.
Yes. I also think that clearly none of the clinical markers of binge eating disorder are necessarily present in this.
Uh-huh. Correct. Yeah.
And people are very quick to assume all fat people have binge eating disorder, or all eating a lot is binge eating disorder.
Yeah.
And that is so dangerous for fat people who both do and don't have binge eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So... in the next scene, Liz comes over and tries to give him this, like, I don't know, kind of like, what's it called? One of those machines that, like, tells you if
it's
you're
like
going to
have a heart attack. It's like a stress test, essentially.
Thing. Yeah.
We're not doctors here.
No, we definitely are not. I would love to hear a doctor's perspective on this. Or maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I would hate that.
That sounds way worse.
Anyway, so she's trying to teach him to calm himself down so he doesn't get his heart rate up and his blood pressure up. He tells her how Ellie came over and that she's very angry. And so many of Liz's lines. I'm like, oh my fucking God. Liz says, I'd be angry too. Daddy running off when I was a kid and turning gay and gaining 500 pounds. Charlie, calm down. The number's going up again. I wonder why, bitch. Sorry, I hate her.
Let me just stress you out and then punish you for getting stressed.
Literally, that's their entire relationship. Maya's face right now is so precious. Maya's jaw on the floor.
I can't believe. Like, this was also something that Abby and I said when we were talking to each other earlier. We were like, no wonder he wants to kill himself, because literally everyone in his life is violently abusing him.
They're horrible for no reason. He is clearly the nicest person in this.
For real.
He's meant to be seen, and we'll talk about this later, as kind of a Jesus figure.
Mm-hmm.
If you read The Idiot by Dostoevsky, he is the lead character of that. Like, Prince Mishkin, if you've read the book. But holy shit, like, he's like, supposedly is kind of morally this, like, tragic martyr.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone in his life is horrible to him. And yet we're supposed to view his martyrdom as independent from that in some way. I don't even know.
Yeah. I just want to say at the end of the last scene, Ellie, like, demanding that he walk toward her.
really made me upset. I will just say that. Come over here. Walk toward me. Come over here beside me. Shut up. Come over here. And he's like really struggling and can't do it. And when I was reading that, I was really like envisioning something very like sinister and horrifying.
Like she's trying to kill him?
No, she's somehow like playing with him or wanting to see a disabled person struggle.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
I think that's what it is too.
And that just like makes me sick to like think about.
I mean, we established she's a fucked up little girl. She has a blog, everyone.
She has, oh God, you know that's the hallmark of a troubled teen. Mm-hmm. I had a blog too, but it was all pictures of waterfalls and Harry Potter memes, so.
How millennial of you.
Yeah.
What can I say? It was the golden days of Tumblr. Anyway, in this next scene, Liz gives Charlie 2 meatball subs. He chokes on one, and she has to Heimlich him, which takes her throwing her entire body on top of him.
Right.
And then, after she saves his life, she says, "You fat piece of shit, what's wrong with you?" And she says, "You're fucking worthless, Charlie, you know that?" He says, "I'm sorry, Liz." What the actual fuck is this relationship?
Chew your food like a normal human being. You could have died right in front of me, all because you're trying to eat that fucking sub as fast as you can. Okay. Leave my house, maybe. Fuck off.
Yeah. Mm-mm. But she's his only source of medical care and friendship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's captive.
Yeah, he's in an abusive relationship with Liz. Like
100%.
That's what this is, for sure.
Textbook.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, then she's like, "Wanna watch TV?" The end.
Slay.
Of the scene.
What a wonderful human experience we are witnessing.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
I feel much empathy.
Oh, my God. Okay. Anyway, Ellie comes over again in the next scene, and they're talking about her, like, he's trying to get her to, like, understand literature and whatever. And she's
just really resistant.
Yeah.
She's very, like, resistant to learning anything, doesn't think it's fucking cool. She's a teen, you know?
She's hashtag not like most girls. I get it.
Right. And he eventually just kind of agrees to like to write her stuff for her, just because he was trying to have some sort of, you know, teaching moment with her, but she's very, very resistant to it.
Then he starts asking questions about her mother, who he talks to like once a month. And this is a part that stuck out to me. He says, "Is your mother with anyone now?" Ellie says, "No, why are you interested?" He says, "Oh no, I was just..." And Ellie's like, "I'm kidding, Jesus, how could you be with anyone?" Pause. "Why did you gain all that weight?"
Nice.
That's pretty much what the script is like.
So the frustrating thing about their interactions, so I, in a weird way, understand and empathize with how unbearably cruel she is to him, because teenagers say wild shit to people when they're angry. Mm-hmm. And she is justifiably very angry because he's not been a presence in her life. I understand this. So for her to just kind of go for the jugular like this and hit him with a lot of these comments, I understand. But the fact that she is not the only person in his life that communicates with him in this way, it then reduces her character to just feeling like everybody else. Like there's no bite or power to this. It just feels like same old for Charlie. And
that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think that it kind of hurts. Like I'm really trying not to give this the play the benefit of the doubt at all, because it's awful.
No, you should. This should be a balanced telling of the play, and both things can be true. I'm totally fine to give this play the benefit of the doubt.
Like I think I understand like what they're going for with her character, because it makes sense to me that she would communicate to him in this way. It does not make sense to me that Liz would. It does not make sense to me that anybody who communicates with him would.
I totally agree.
Yeah. The only nice person to him is the person who doesn't know him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, I think Ellie's resentment towards him would make a lot of sense if it was explored in any meaningful way, but it just kind of,
it's not.
Never really gotten to the bottom of like her hurt and trauma at like him walking out on their family to be with a man. Like, that's a very traumatic thing.
I feel like it would make sense if it was kind of, if it was less like on the surface all the time, because I do feel like teenage girls, it takes a little bit of prodding, and if something, if, you know, she was irritated enough that he was asking her things that she didn't want to talk about, then there could be like snaps there that would seem more earned. It kind of just seems like he invites her over to like berate him for 2 hours and then leave.
I could see her starting out like this, and then over the course of the play, you see like the hurt that's underneath, but she doesn't really have much of an arc.
No.
She doesn't get character development, which is so weird. I mean, it's very weird. If anybody in this play gets any character development, I would say it's Liz.
Yeah, I would say Liz, and to a very weird extent, I think we haven't met her yet, but Ellie's mom, I think.
Oh, yeah, no, she's like the most interesting side character. She's the most interesting character. She's in one scene.
Yeah, it's...
Oh, my God.
It's pretty wild. And, I mean, I will say this, though, to give the play credit where credit is due. Obviously, not a one-to-one comparison, but in addition to being a fat person, I'm also a cancer survivor. I am a pancreatic cancer survivor, to be specific, which if you know anything about that condition, it is a death sentence. If you get diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, you are not expected to survive. So for many years of my life, I did operate under the impression that I was dying and I was going to die very quickly. So I completely understand Charlie wanting to have this, like, I guess this final moment with Ellie because he believes that he's dying, even if it's horrible and abusive, because I went through the same thing. Yeah. I stayed in a horrifically abusive relationship when I was sick because I did not want to die alone. So I understand a lot of his character from this perspective, but again, I don't think this is a well-written play and is not exploring it in ways that are meaningful at all whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so then it's revealed in this scene that Charlie started eating when his boyfriend died, and his boyfriend, Alan, died by slowly killing himself, having the flu, he got pneumonia, but he stopped eating before that.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically starved himself to death. Ellie says, why wouldn't he eat anything? And Charlie says, because he felt guilty. And they kind of leave it there.
Yep.
Then Elder Thomas comes back, and while Charlie is in the bathroom, he and Ellie kind of have a moment where she is also mean to him.
Yep.
And he kind of gives her shit back in a way that almost nobody else does, which I like.
Yeah.
I like. I think I like him. And he's trying to, you know, convert Charlie.
Right.
And Ellie's critical of religion. And after being pretty mean to him, when he goes to leave, she's like, come back tomorrow.
A little flirting, maybe.
Maybe.
A little.
In Ellie's universe, that could be flirting.
That's also very teenage boy.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's also very like Helga Pataki form of flirting. Of like, I have a shrine to you in my closet, but also I hate you and I'm going to be so mean to you.
Yeah.
Anyway, Elder Thomas then tells Charlie about the Book of Mormon and won't tell his first name. And they sort of debate the Book of Mormon. Charlie's like, why did you come back here? And Elder Thomas is like, well, you listened to me and it seems like you need it. Like you need to be saved, I guess.
Yeah.
And he says, well, I'm not interested in converting. And Elder Thomas is like, wait, why are you here? And then he's like, you're not attracted to me, right? Because, you know, every time a fat person or a gay person wants to spend time with anybody, they're definitely gonna fucking assault you. So
for real. I kind of enjoyed Charlie's reaction to that. Charlie was like, you're a fetus. Please.
Yeah, I liked that too.
Can I also mention that the Book of Mormon, as in the musical, was launched in 2011, so right before this, because the way that they discuss Mormonism in this play feels like somebody learned about Mormonism from Matt Stone and Trey Parker. And... like down to some like repetitive points of just like, I think Liz later says it like, yeah. And then you'll die and you'll get your own planet. Like it really feels like, hey, we have a relationship with this hot new show on Broadway. And like, whether that was his intention or not, I do not know, but it blasted in my head the entire time I was reading it. Like just hearing it, I was like, this sounds way, way too similar to both the musical and then also the South Park episode of Joseph Smith, dum, 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 dum. Like, it just, they're way too close for it to feel coincidental to me.
That is funny. I will give Sam Hunter the benefit of the doubt here because he is from Idaho, and I know there is a pretty strong Mormon presence there. Mm. It's not that far from Salt Lake. The one Mormon person that I grew up with moved to Idaho. So I wouldn't be surprised if he grew up around some Mormons.
Mm.
But it is funnily coincidental, and I'm sure that helped this play's marketing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't doubt that he specifically chose Mormon, like a Mormon missionary, because of his upbringing. I feel the way that in which Mormonism is communicated feels extremely influenced by outside sources.
That's very valid.
It's definitely a non-Mormon's perspective on Mormonism. Yeah,
for sure. And even the character who's supposed to be the authority on Mormonism sounds like somebody who is reading off of a Mormon brochure.
That's like the whole play is just different people from the perspective of not those people.
Yes. Oh, that should be the tagline of this play.
That's the theme. Yep. That's very interesting. Okay. So when they're having this discussion and Charlie's like, I'm not attracted to you, you're a fetus. And he says, is that what you really think of me? Do you find me disgusting? And Elder Thomas says no after a pause. Which is better than anyone else in his life has done.
For real. I was very, like, the bar is so far in hell at this point that, like, Elder Thomas not being like, yeah, you fucking fat loser. Like, I'm like, yay!
We're all like, this man's capacity for empathy.
Unmatched.
Maybe Mormonism is the best.
Mormonism is the one true religion.
Oh my god. This play accidentally converts a bunch of people to Mormons because they feel like they're good for the only other person they see having pity for the fat character is the Mormon.
But at the same time, because I don't want to give this play too much credit, Elder Thomas, though, also has the same energy to me as when people post those, like, clearly, like, clickbaity intentional, like, look at this baby with all of these different physical problems. Look, like, her persistence is great. And then there's the parade of people that comment, like, but she's so beautiful and wonderful. And you're like, are you saying this because you actually believe it or because you need to feel good for being the person who commented that this baby is beautiful? That's how I feel about Elder Thomas.
Sometimes when people, like when I make a TikTok talking about how fat people get treated like shit and someone comes in the comments and is like, but you're beautiful. I'm like, you have to
say
that.
That's accurate.
My feelings about it, I have a rule. If the word that you're using to describe me can also describe a Christmas tree, I don't believe you.
That's so funny.
You're so luminescent.
Like, yeah.
It's always the really over-the-top compliments that kind of give me the ick. Like, where people are like, your presence is so stunning to me. And I'm like,
okay. You light up a room.
Just compliment my tits like a normal person.
Bean dip me and walk away. Come on.
Oh my god. Anyway, Charlie asks about his church, and Elder Thomas says, is this about your boyfriend who died? And he reveals that, like, Liz told him about Alan. Charlie basically tells the love story of him and Alan. And
now we have a gay trope. Of an age gap relationship.
Yes. He was a student.
Indeed we do. A student teacher.
Yes.
I do like that it tries to clarify, yeah. Like, he was only a couple of years younger and it was after his missionary. So they're not trying to say that he was underage, just but it's so still, you know. Like, right. Come on. Why did it have to be this circumstance? There's so many ways that this person could have met him.
For real.
Exactly. And anyway, he says he was the engaged son of a Mormon bishop. I had a wife and kid at home, but we just couldn't stand to be apart. We started a new life together, and he thought that Alan would be able to get over all the Mormonism stuff, but he did not. And he just, like, had a lot of trauma about that Mormon church. His father abandoned him until he showed up one night and said, I wrote a sermon for you. You have to come tomorrow because the sermon is for you. He went to the service. And then after he came home, he stopped He stopped everything, is a quote. He stopped bathing, he stopped eating, he stopped sleeping. And a few months later, he was gone.
Yep.
So Charlie wants Elder Thomas to find out what that sermon was about.
Yeah, it's clear that, like, that's why Charlie had been interested in talking to Elder Thomas, because he's interested in figuring out what was going on that day and what they spoke about and what triggered Alan to, you know, decide to not.
As a gay person, I am just very tired of the constant trope of gay person miserable because religious trauma. A lot of us are secular. Would love to see that. Sometimes the issues we have with our parents have nothing to do with religion. But again, it feels like this like immediate shorthand thing where you can incite a lot of empathy for a gay person because everybody universally knows that religions are not kind to gay people, or at least the
right.
more dominant religions. It's just, it's very lazy writing.
It's very tired, for sure.
Yes. And how do you feel as a fat gay person about this idea of basically, like, the sort of shame and the internalized homophobia causing one person to stop eating and one person to eat himself to death, as the synopsis says?
I have a lot of hard feelings about it because I think that it is relying so heavily on tropes. The entirety of the whale, because obviously we're dealing with a lot of whale metaphor, just the title is whale, which I don't know a single fat person in my life who hasn't been compared to Shamu at some point in their lives. The fact that there's the essay about Moby Dick, the fact that there's later religious associations with whales. The best way I can describe it is it's when you're watching a teen movie and then there is a scene where they're in a classroom and what they're learning about happens to be the thing that they're dealing with in the movie. I'll even cite a Brendan Fraser movie. It's Encino Man when they happen to be learning about Cro-Magnon Man, that unit in history, where it's like, we fucking get it, dude. I get the metaphor that you're working with here. Like, this person's response was to starve and this person's response was to eat forever. There are so many other ways to cope. And this is, again, lazy. Your metaphors are boring.
Yes. Anyway, Liz comes over and is like, why is Elder Thomas here? And then she brings Charlie a wheelchair.
I will say, I'm so sorry. I want to interject something.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I think that putting Alan and Charlie, kind of comparing them to each other, is also, like, supposed to, again, elicit empathy from the audience. Because I'm gonna be real, like, and this is someone who has been in this place, someone who is anorexic, someone who has issues like withholding food restriction, and is losing weight as a result. Like, there is a lot of empathy for those people. There is so much empathy reserved for those people. And like, oh my God, what are they going through? And it can be incredibly infantilizing and irritating. But there is still empathy reserved for those people that is not reserved for fat people in any case. So I think partially the author is trying to be like, see, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. All fat people.
Yes.
All fat people that are that big are just doing what the skinny, tiny people who starve themselves are doing.
Is this like the reverse racism argument for anorexia? Because that's what it feels like this play is doing.
So I kind of feel like Samuel D. Hunter was putting this comparison in as like a mic drop.
I agree completely. You like, oh, I just, because I'm a bad person, I just imagine him like at his computer typing this up and he's like, they're not going to know it hit them.
Did you ever think that it's the same?
walks away from explosion.
I mean, I guess if we're being really charitable, one could say that it is good for people to find empathy in whatever way that they can. And that there is a lot of empathy for eating disorder that makes you too skinny, but no empathy for eating disorder that makes you too fat. So I guess in equating them, yeah, it's a shallow comparison, but hopefully it works. I don't know. But it is extremely unsophisticated writing, which is not how I remembered the play. Because I had it hyped up so much. And you know what? I saw a Samuel D. Hunter play at the theater where I work last year. It was phenomenal. he's gotten so much better as a writer. Proud of him.
Growth.
We love growth.
We love it. Just hope that maybe he could also grow in his understanding of the fat
for
experience.
Sure.
Or maybe just stay in your lane, buddy.
Yeah, just don't.
Word. And you know what? This play did stay in his lane, and that's why it was better.
Good.
It was about two, like, middle-aged dudes with kids.
There you go.
Perfect. Because we need more of them.
Write what you know.
But it was about economic hardship. That seems to be a theme in a lot of his plays. It's less explicit in this one, but
it's certainly there.
Yeah, it's at least coded in there. Anyway, he's now got a wheelchair, and Liz says, make your own sandwich.
I swear to God.
Then she talks to Elder Thomas while he is making the sandwich. She basically is like, you're never going to convert Charlie. She says, you can't fit a round peg in a square hole, and you certainly can't fit a morbidly obese gay peg in a Mormon hole. That came out wrong.
Again, just add the keyboard, like, what a good line.
That's like me writing. That's like me writing, like, that's what she said in every, like, English textbook.
For real.
Half my notes were like, check out the syntax and, like,
I highlighted the metaphor.
Fancy literary term. And then the rest were like, 69, 420. And that's high school.
It. That's the experience.
Anyway, Liz tells Elder Thomas a story about how her brother went on a mission trip to Switzerland. He was cold and lonely, but he didn't want to come back and get married. He got engaged to a girl he didn't know and refused to go through with the wedding and fell in love with someone else. Started a whole new life until one day he went back to the church and then he started wasting away until he was just gone. That was my little brother,
Mic
Alan.
Mic drop. Absolute explosion. Yeah. You didn't see that coming, did ya?
So it turns out Liz is Alan's sister. Reveal! And then she sort of questions why Elder Thomas is alone. He's like, my partner's not doing well. He's pretty useless right now, he says. Because Mormons travel in pairs, as we know if we've seen the Book of Mormon.
Right. Two by two.
Exactly. Anyway, so Liz says, you can't save him. I'm the only one who can save him. Methinks I smell some savior complex, Liz.
Just a little bit. And I will give her a little bit of credit here. Her brother did die, and I'm sure there's some guilt.
Well, yeah, she couldn't save him, so she wants to save Charlie instead.
Mm-hmm. So it is a savior complex, but it at least is rooted somewhere that makes canonical sense within the text.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes. It does make sense. However, it is kind of fucked up for her to be like, well, I couldn't save my brother, so I'm going to have to save you.
Meanwhile, bucket of chicken and two meatball subs. Great job.
Yeah. Cool.
And verbal abuse.
Word. All things that are extremely conducive to health.
Woo!
You'd think that if she's so mad at him for being fat, she'd, like, bring him a kale salad or something.
Oh, for real.
It's very weird.
The decisions make no sense.
But then it's like, maybe she's feeding him to make him unhealthy so he'll need her more. Oh. Like Misty from Yellow Jackets, if you guys watched that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm obsessed.
Yes.
Wait. Oh, my God. We should talk after this. I'm forcing my boyfriend through it currently. But anyway, he is reading Ellie's notebook that just says, this apartment smells, this notebook is our word, I hate it. And he's like, she's so smart.
He's literally like, he loves this little child. I would be like throwing this baby out the window at this point.
See, my thing is like, why didn't he ever like try to be a part of her life? Because like, when we meet Mary, we'll see this a little more, but it just doesn't seem like it's that there's that much animosity anymore. It is kind of explained, but anyway.
Yeah.
He's like telling his students, forget about everything, just write something truthful. Like, I don't care what you write, because he's dying.
He's like, fuck it. I don't care. This is like his last hurrah. Yeah. He's like, write nothing. I don't give a shit. Write whatever.
So I've not seen the staging like, I've not seen the show with my eyes, so I don't know how this is staged, but I'm going to say something kind of shitty and sacrilege as somebody with a degree in theater. But every time they cut back to him communicating with the students, all I can think about is some director getting a hold of this script and like putting the single spotlight on this moment. And it's like, see this, this is telling you how the play is moving forward. This is the symbol of the emotional and character growth. Like this is the message to take away from it.
Plays are so on the nose.
Yes. It is like, come on. Why are we indicating this hard, my dude?
Yeah, yep. Like I saw a play today and it was good, but there was a lot of like talking to the audience about what the play's about. And I just.
Just holding the audience's hand.
I feel that that is a little bit lazy.
Yeah.
So the next scene is Ellie and Charlie, and he finally tells her that the word she loves to use, her favorite word, is offensive. And she uses it. Again, to tell him to fuck off, basically. And they sort of get into the actual divorce that happened and how he, like, came home and basically was like, I'm gay and I'm leaving. And Ellie says she has this memory of him being on the ground looking pathetic and fat.
Right.
And Charlie says, I know you're angry, but just be angry at me. Don't be angry at the whole world.
Man.
Ellie says that he's no more important than anyone else who's treated her poorly. And he doesn't understand why she didn't send money beyond child support. And he just says, I'm sorry. And then at the end of this scene, this is a horrible thing. He says, what were you writing about? She says, I was writing about how when you die, you won't fit through the door or window. So they'll probably have to take you out in pieces.
So that... Okay, I'm gonna get a little candid here. I'm obviously not gonna use names for the respect of the people that I know and love, but I last year lost somebody very dear to me, and it is a lot of factors, but it all boils down, like, the inciting incident is medical fat phobia. So also, I guess, like, massive trigger warning for this. But during their treatment and as things were happening, there were many instances where their caregiver, who could not handle the fact of what they were going through, would like go out and get drunk. And then they would not be available when transportation would arrive to take my friend to the hospital, because you have to have certain things set up when you are of a certain size. And if you miss that window, like, it's not like they can just call a regular ambulance for you again, because that's just not how it works. So that was like a big point of contention. And when things were getting bad, like, there had to be a conscious decision made to transport this person to a medical facility to pass, specifically because of the fear of what would happen if they would have passed in the home. Like, these are genuine concerns people have. So to see it kind of mocked in this way so flippantly is, again, like, a sign of that ignorance. Like, it feels like such a sensationalist comment when that is an absolutely real factor for a lot of people. I also grew up near somebody who did pass in a similar way, and they had to, like, disassemble their home to get them out. And it was very traumatic to witness as a small fat child. And again, like, these are realities for people that are just being talked about in a way that, like, it feels like it's being written from a perspective where, like, this is so out of the realm of possibility, it makes it okay to talk about, or it makes it okay to insult in this way, sort of like horror movie logic in a way, where it's like, yeah, we can go this far because this is not real, but this is real for people. And, like, that is the line for me in this movie. Like, I know you had mentioned earlier, like, your least favorite line. That's my least favorite line. Like, it gutted me when I read it. I could not believe it.
Yeah.
I think that there are a lot of things in this play where it's like, I don't know, because I haven't had the personal experience, whether it is a real thing that people of Charlie's size deal with, or whether it is the sick imagination of a person imagining what would have happened if I had gotten fatter and fatter and if I had ended up like this.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense.
I can't tell if it's a horror story nightmare dream or if it is a real research thing.
Right.
This play actually, you know, to its credit, it's made me realize how little I understand about the lives of people who are this fat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's made me so aware of my privilege as a small fat person.
For real.
Same.
I've never been more aware of that in my life than watching all the discourse about this too, because the way that people are so opposed to the backlash, it's very telling about what they think about people this size, mm-hmm. that they will not at least openly say they think about someone like me.
Yeah,
absolutely. And obviously we can get to it later, but there are a lot of contributing factors to the discourse that cannot be ignored, but that is a conversation for later.
Yes, we will get to it. So the next scene, Ellie and Elder Thomas chat again, and Elder Thomas reveals that he had a weed addiction.
LOL. That's okay.
Yes, he says, I had a problem. Ellie says, you were a stoner, you had a hobby, which I think is the funniest line in this show.
Agreed.
Anyway, Ellie reveals that she has given Charlie 2 sleeping pills, and so he's sleeping, and she threatens to give him the rest of the pills if Elder Thomas leaves. So he is stuck there with her.
So that's good. That's super normal.
Yeah, that was one of the places where I was like, I know she's angry, but this seems a little too far.
We're bordering on some problems.
There's like some murder a little
it's
bit.
It's giving
in there.
Murder.
Anyway, they end up smoking together, and she takes pictures of him smoking. He's like, "What are you going to do with the picture?" And she basically won't tell him.
She's like, "I'm not going to do anything with it." And then, you know, there's some hints of flirting stuff in there. Ellie's like, you find me attractive. And
Ellie reveals that she's looked up Elder Thomas and that he is not on a mission. Elder Thomas was like, I was on a mission, but I basically deserted because it was so demoralizing when people would just like slam the door in his face over and over, basically. So he felt like he wasn't really helping people. But, he felt like he could really help Charlie, and he assaulted his roommate because his roommate wouldn't do anything. So that's why he ended up getting kicked off the mission. And then Ellie's mom shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie's ex-wife.
Mary.
Yes. She clearly still cares about Charlie very much, I think.
Yeah.
I think so, too.
He is, like, doing very bad after waking up from the sleeping pills he was drugged with.
Yep.
Basically, everyone is in agreement that he is deteriorating quickly.
Liz is there as well.
Right. Liz also shows up.
Yeah.
And Mary basically is interrogating Ellie about how much money Charlie gave her to come over, because she knows that Ellie wouldn't come over on her own.
Mm-hmm.
And Liz is like, what are you talking about? He doesn't have any money. And Mary is like, she doesn't know you have a ton of money. Like, so anyway, Liz finds out and she's very upset because she's been doing everything for him when he could have afforded all these things to make his life more comfortable or to get help or whatever.
Right.
She's understandably very upset.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's been for Ellie. It's always been for Ellie. But it's like, then I don't know. Why did you never reach out to her before?
He said that he like offered to help with certain things, like to fix her car when it broke down.
Liz's car.
Yeah, Liz's car, because that was an issue. But
right.
But she rejects it because she thinks he has no money and is like, I'm not going to take those funds from you. And I think the situation with Mary and Charlie, it feels a little convenient to the plot. Where Mary reveals like, oh, well, I fought for full custody and also I didn't want you seeing her because I didn't want to give you the satisfaction, blah, 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 blah. Like a lot of the reasonings that she's given, it just feels very convenient of this is why he was not around and was an absent father, but I still want you to think that he's a really good person. Let me blame it on this woman.
I think it's also very necessary. If we are going into writing this play saying, I want to get the audience to empathize with this very fat man. So like, we have to establish that this person has fucking no character flaws and is not like a layered person who has done shit.
Again, Jesus, martyr. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mary's mad at him for giving Ellie all this money because she's like, she's in high school. She's going to just spend it on weed or something.
Yes.
Which is fair. She probably would.
Yeah.
She'd probably spend it on something harder than weed.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Mary says Ellie's awful, basically.
Yeah. I do love a parent that can admit when their kid is being a shit, though. I love that.
I love that. I really do love it. Like, it's fucking awesome to read someone who is, like, aware of Ellie just being kind of, like, not well-adjusted and not, things are not working out well in that department.
So, basically, Charlie is, like... Basically, it comes out that the reason Mary's been keeping Ellie from Charlie partially is because Mary thinks Ellie's a bad person and she doesn't want Charlie to see that she is, in her eyes, failed as a mother. But Charlie doesn't think she's awful. Charlie thinks she's perfect.
Charlie is obsessed.
Charlie sees the good in everyone because he is the wise oracle because he is Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is like the owner of like a scraggly tiny little dog that does nothing but like shit and piss everywhere and yell at people and try to bite them. And they're like, this is my little squishum.
Oh my god, that's baby. So true.
And in a very weird way, I think that it's also like a contributing factor to how we're supposed to view him as like, oh, he can't even see how bad she is because he's that good. Like, it's almost a pitying thing where it suddenly makes him also seem like somebody who doesn't understand the difference between bad and good, because he's seeing what we can see as an objectively bad person and he views them as good. So how can we expect him to know how to feed himself or take care of him? He clearly can't.
Interesting.
Ugh.
I think that the fat martyr is a very common trope. Now that I think about it, it's very common. I can actually think of another play, Fat Kids on Fire, which is actually written by one of the writers and producers of This Is Us. And that also has a final scene where a super fat character dies.
Great.
And it's like, she was the too good for this world, believe the best in everyone. Sweet, sweet girl who dies of a heart attack. She drops dead during a dance.
Good lord.
In which she achieves her dream of the unattainable counselor dancing with her out of pity.
Gross.
And then she dies. That is one of my possible least favorite plays ever. It's then revealed that the reason Mary has come over is because she saw on Ellie's blog that Ellie had posted a picture of Charlie with the caption, "When he goes to hell, there'll be plenty of him to burn." And Charlie's response to this is, "She's a strong writer."
Yeah.
Charlie, I don't know if you know what good writing is.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of questioning if you're qualified to teach an English class. I'm not gonna lie.
Oh my god. Oh my god. Anyway, Mary then has this very human moment of not only clearly hating her daughter and acknowledging that she's a bad person, but also that she says she's sorry about Alan and that she like had an interaction with him once and he looked very thin and she carried bags to his car for him. And they sort of reminisce on their relationship and the good times they had as a family. He tells her that he wants her to make sure that Ellie's okay after he's dead. He says she needs someone who won't give up on her. Mary says, "You've been eating yourself to death for 15 years and you're saying that I gave up on her?"
Again, I just have to pop in and say, statistically, if a man is suicidal, he will shoot himself. Thank you. He's not going to do this. Thanks.
In a very weird way, this play is kind of romanticizing self-harm and suicide in a way that I think is really gross, because it's presenting it as this like tortured soul who's just struggling and on this path of self-destruction, which we all know from just mountains of research and evidence-based facts, that's not a thing. Like, that's not a thing. The 27 Club lied to you.
Yeah. I do think that that kind of thing is also, like, I mean, it's romanticized in a lot of situations, just, like, the kind of, like, slow, like, oh, I'm so miserable, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, or, like, hot, skinny girl drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the Queen's Gambit got a lot of criticism for that.
Or the entirety of Darren Aronofsky's filmography. Weird how that happens.
I'm glad we have like film person on this podcast because I'm such a theater person. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to have your knowledge of the film.
For real, we'll get there.
Yes. The next scene is basically Charlie's clearly deteriorating. Elder Thomas comes back. He's really, really high. Ellie had sent pictures of him smoking to the mission, and then his parents found out where he was. He said he can't figure out if she was trying to help him or hurt him. So that's, is Ellie actually a good person?
Surprise, she has a heart of gold with a tough shell. How complicated she is.
Anyway, Elder Thomas reveals his real name to Charlie, and he says, it's not too late to know God's love. You don't have to be in this kind of pain anymore. You don't have to let this body hold your spirit down. To which Charlie says, you're high. But I think he's saying, like, let yourself die, but I also don't know if...
I don't know. I think he's, like, equating being sad with
with
being the size that Charlie is, you know? You don't have to let this body hold your spirit down. I mean, he's just like, you can be happy and you can know God's love even when you're a big fat guy.
Yeah, and actually that's maybe the most fat positive line in this play, oddly enough, which I hate.
Our bodies are a temple and yours is a mega church. Congratulations.
Oh, Elder Thomas has now found out what the speech was about, and it was about Jonah and the whale. And he's like, this is fate, because the essay's about Moby Dick, and both of those things have whales. And then he says, well, Jonah's a story of redemption. Jonah thinks he's going to die, but God sends a whale to keep him safe, and then he prays to get ejected from the whale, and he does, so you need to pray too.
When this moment happens, I just need you to know that the first thing that pops in my head is the moment in Ruthless when she screams, you're indicating, because it feels like there is a neon sign above Elder Thomas's head that is like, this is the moral, this is what you're to take of this, and it's like, God fucking
anyway, so it's like, okay, so actually Charlie's boyfriend heard about Jonah and the whale and then stopped living, lost the will to live.
And then wasted away.
Elder Thomas said he thinks that's because he probably saw getting married to a Mormon lady as heeding the call of God, and that he felt like he was refusing the call of God. So... that's Elder Thomas's explanation, which to me sounds kind of far-fetched, and like it was just a bit of a reach to get the whale in there.
And also the metaphor doesn't make sense, because if he is the whale is the one who offered Jonah comfort and safety. So what are you talking about?
Right. Well, no, I think he's Jonah and he has to pray to God to not kill him, but I'm not totally sure. It's a little confusing. I do not understand, but maybe I'm just dumb.
It's just not good, I don't think.
No, because like, the metaphor doesn't work. Because Jonah prays to God and God sends the whale and the whale protects him. So right. If Charlie is the whale, then Charlie is the source of protection.
But he's not the whale. Elder Thomas is saying he's Jonah.
Oh, that's even dumber.
Okay, so they're trying to be like, did you think he was the whale? No. We're saying he is not his body. He is Jonah.
I don't even know.
What?
I don't even know.
Huh?
Because who would Jonah be? Who's he eating? Like, I don't understand.
Who are we eating?
He's not good enough.
What is going on?
He's not a bad enough person to be a cannibal.
Well,
he's Jesus.
Well, because if the sermon is what Alan heard, though, like, that's the thing that doesn't track with me. Because, like, what is Alan supposed to take from this that's going to traumatize him so deeply? That's where the metaphor doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. It does not track. Like, that just seems like a pretty benign sermon. I don't know.
Like, did he just Google, like, famous whale parables and novels? Like, what happened here?
Oh my God. Yeah, I just simply don't understand how that's the key to this whole thing. And then Charlie's like, you think Alan died and I'm dying right now because we didn't ask God for help? Elder Thomas is like, yes. And Charlie's like, get out of my apartment.
The first sensible thing he's done this entire fucking play.
I know, the first time he ever asserts himself. And then he says, you know, I wasn't always this big.
Oh, buddy.
Yeah, because he has to justify that actually he is a real person because once he wasn't mm-hmm. an animal. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of fat people do this. And he said, I wasn't the best looking guy in the room, but Alan still loved me and thought I was beautiful and sexy. And then Charlie tells like their love story and how they like hooked up, they kissed, they laid together in bed naked, they had sex. And he says, and this is actually the worst line in the play for me.
Yeah.
And I'm going to just read it word for word. And I hope that there isn't any God, because I hate thinking that there's an afterlife, that Alan can see what I've done to myself, that he can see my swollen feet, the sores on my skin, the patches of mold in between the flaps, the infected ulcers on my ass, the underwear that Liz made for me out of old bedsheets covered in shit and piss, the sack of fat on my back that I can't reach anymore that turned brown last year. And then he says, this is disgusting. Elder Thomas is like, yes. And so finally, Elder Thomas, like everyone else in Charlie's life, tells him he's disgusting.
This moment and that description is the fatphobic equivalent of when your sex education course is nothing but the most graphic photos of STIs you've ever seen in your life. It is a scared straight tactic. That's what this is. And it is horrible. Horrible.
This whole play is a scared straight tactic.
Yeah.
And that's another one of those things where I'm like, I don't know how common this is. Or if it's just the nightmare of a thin person, if that makes sense.
I think it's the nightmare of a thin person.
Yeah, it's certainly there are medical things that large fat people deal with that I do not know and that a lot of us are not aware of. But it's the way that it's set up, you know? It's the fact that he's like yelling at someone and attempting to elicit a reaction of disgust about these things that like can happen. Like certain things, I don't know about mold, but like.
So, okay. The unfortunate reality is that is a possibility.
Yeah.
If it gets to that point. But it really does, like, it feels like a scared straight situation where, like, yes, of course, this is within the realm of possibility, but to give a laundry list like that is so excessive and unnecessary and is intentional. Like,
yeah. Ugh. It's the way that it's listed out, like bullet points, that is just like.
This is the body horror of it all.
Yeah, yes. That is, yeah.
This entire play operates under. It sounds really bad, but I refer to it as like the Courtney Shane clause, which is a reference to the movie Jawbreaker, where they come up with this elaborate lie as to what happened to their friend. And the justification is they'll believe it because it's their worst nightmare, which is this idea that if you say something like super out of like just out of left field or very extreme or really excessive, people tend to believe it because why would you make something up like that?
Right.
So there's a lot of that happening in this play where they're saying things that sound so horrific that your brain is like, well, that must be true. That must be a thing that happens. And you start to add logic as to how that could be a possibility and how that would happen. And just, oh boy.
Yep.
Yep.
That's a very, very good point.
Yeah.
So Elder Thomas says, basically, why won't you just let me help you? And Charlie says, because you think I'm disgusting. You've always thought that I was disgusting. And then tells him to get out. That feels somehow poignant, but I don't know exactly why. Does that make sense?
It feels poignant to me in a way where Charlie is acknowledging that any help he receives from somebody who treats him or views him in this way, like, it's not going to be from a good place. And at that point, like, you're not even actually helping.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's also him being like, you only were nice to me because you thought you could save me in that sense. And the same thing is true of Liz.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then Charlie in the next scene is teaching his English class and it's revealed that he's fired. He's been fired. He reads some of the things that people have written in that are like not about literature. And he says, I want to be honest with you, and shows his body. On webcam. And then he says, none of this matters. You're all beautiful. And he throws his computer across the room and breaks it.
I think we're supposed to feel like this is a big, powerful movement or gesture that he's making, but it leads into like the martyrdom thing of like, I'm bearing myself raw to you. Look how brave I am. Feel pity upon me.
Now mm-hmm. This is his crucifixion scene, if we're going to play with the Jesus metaphor.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Literally is Jesus. So then Liz comes over. Charlie immediately apologizes for the computer, I guess. Basically, they sort of have it out about the money. She says, we could have made you more comfortable. We could have gotten you all these things to make your life easier or gotten you into treatment. He said, after all that, I'd still be dying and Ellie wouldn't have any money, which is like, is that true? Because I feel like he's like, well, fat people are going to die no matter what medical intervention we get.
I'm sure that it does seem that Charlie is like drinking the Kool-Aid on that mm-hmm. business. And I think that that is also necessary for the audience to empathize with him, quote unquote. Is that he is not a fat person who is like aware of anti-fatness and pushing against it in any way.
Well, but the thing is, because it's Charlie's opinion, it's the play's opinion in this case. Mm-hmm. And so the audience hears that and they say, oh yeah, it doesn't matter what you do for fat people, they're still just going to die. So what's the point of doing anything for fat people and spending our tax dollars on it or whatever?
So what's the point of like working on medical inequities mm-hmm. for fat people? What's the point?
Because they're just going to die anyway.
It also just doesn't make sense in the way that our medical system works. Because say Charlie says, F it, I'm buying health insurance. Given what we know about his health circumstances, he is hitting his deductible very quickly. And then he can get everything that he needs and Ellie will still have money. So even the play's logic doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. Well, the point is that he doesn't care because he wants to be dead. That's the point.
Yes, yes. Because this is the internalized body episode of Hoarders.
Sorry, the only way, I'm sorry, the only way that the playwright can imagine someone getting this fat is if they intentionally are trying to die.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That just fucking blows my mind. Nobody wants to be this fat. Nobody wants to have all these things denied to them. Like, nobody,
yes.
You know what I mean? No one wants to live this life.
Yes.
Duh. And no one wants, and people don't get fat to die. Like, I'm sorry.
I just...
Maybe they do have a binge eating disorder. Maybe they do have, like, an overeating problem. But the most we've seen him eat is 2 sandwiches.
For real. Mm-hmm.
That's not enough for this to be happening.
And this is... Okay, and this is something that I've just seen TikTok people commenting on things. Telling people that it's not actually starvation if a very fat person doesn't eat anything.
So... Mm-hmm. That is the source of my person close to me passing. They were starving, but because they were a large person, a medical professional did not listen to them. And that is what happened. And that's what started the domino effect that led to their passing.
God fucking damn it.
And I know, it's just like flip an entire building at this point, is how I feel about it. And I genuinely think that people are under the impression that if fat people starve themselves, that their body will just operate off of our existing fat. And that's
how it works. They 100% are. They think it's just stored energy.
People literally think that, like, your body, like, however much fat you have, your fucking reserves will go, like, walk into your stomach and go, like, I'll take this. Nom, nom, nom. Good energy.
I guess it's ketosis in a way, I think.
It eats away at, like, your muscle, though, first.
It does, yeah.
And do you know what muscles are? Organs. Organs are muscles.
Yeah. That's how people die. Nice.
Anyway, Liz says, I hate you for putting me through this again, because she already went through it with Alan. And... she reveals she found him dead. Then Liz says, I got you 2 meatball subs, extra cheese. I don't know what I'm doing.
I mean, finally she says it.
Then she slaps him and says, how dare you do this to me again? And Charlie, as he's eating, barely able to breathe, says she helped him, meaning Ellie helped Elder Thomas, and that he's going home because of Ellie. Anyway, Liz is freaking out. Then Ellie comes in. Liz is like, he's dying. So Liz leaves to go call the ambulance.
And then Charlie and Ellie are alone. And Ellie takes out the essay that Charlie gave her to turn in. And she's like, I failed this.
Yes, because it was her original Moby Dick essay.
Uh-huh.
That, which doesn't make sense, because what was even the assignment? But whatever.
Yeah, it's not
anyway,
clear.
He gave her her own essay. And he's like, it's a great essay. She's like, no, it's not.
Because it's and not.
It's not.
It's not. And she's like, I wrote this in eighth grade for English. Like, why do you have this? And Charlie says, your mom sent it to me, and it's the best essay I've ever read. And Ellie's like, literally, why are you fucking with me? Charlie's like, no, I'm not. You're beautiful. This essay is amazing. Like, and Ellie's just like, the fuck? And he's clearly, like, going.
Right.
He's dying.
He's walking into the light.
Yeah, basically. Basically. And then he tells her to read it to him. She says, you asshole, you fat fucking asshole.
Nice.
Yeah. He says, just read it. She says, fuck you. He says, please. She says, fuck you. He says, Ellie. She says, dad, please. And then she reads it. And then he stands up and starts to walk across the room as she reads the essay. And then it cuts off abruptly, a la End of the Sopranos. Spoiler. Oops. And, well, that didn't give anything away, because it doesn't give anything away. But I was spoiled for The Sopranos by She-Hulk, so.
To be fair, it's been like a decade.
I was just watching it now. Anyway, the end, the last stage direction, is Charlie looks up, a sharp intake of breath, the waves cut off, the lights snapped black, end of play. So he dies walking across the room.
Because remember that scene in Act 1 where she was like, hey, come walk to me? We've come full circle. Yes. Wow. Yes. Callback. I hate this play so much, just not only on like an ethical and like philosophical level, but also because it just feels like somebody got assigned how to write a play and followed it step by step by step. Like, yeah.
I can't believe I defended how well written this play was, because truly upon my third read, I was like, no.
Like, no. It's a little stinky guy. I do not like this.
A little stinky guy.
And I think that I think the reason that we're able to see that at least now is because if you have done even like a half second of like anti-fat education or knowledgement, you can see through all of the sensational bits that are going to elicit those natural emotional responses that people are getting that find this to be this beautiful moving work of art, because they can't see through the bullshit. But we can see through the bullshit, so then all we're left with is a poorly structured play.
Yes.
And honestly, it is a very, it's very high stakes, because it's like, you know, he's going to die from the first minute of Act One, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this play is the slow march toward death. So how can that not be a little bit riveting? It even got me a little at the beginning when I was reading it this third time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what had got me previously, was like that you, it kind of hooks you because it's so high stakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is really, I think, the best thing I could say about this play, and where a lot of its power is that you're just kind of on the edge of your seat waiting for him to die the whole time.
Mm-hmm. And it's also, I feel like it's important just like atmospherically for the play that there is a lot of like musical interludes going on, specifically with like waves crashing and like build up of waves and water and, you know, the whole whale thing.
Right, the waves get closer, the closer he is to death.
Mm-hmm.
I think people are also really got by the whale. Like, all the layers of the
really
title.
Just, it's a whale onion, and you keep peeling back the layers, and it's
whales
just
are
more
like
whales.
Onions.
The whale is like an onion. You just keep pulling back the layers, and there's more whale metaphors.
But are any of them good? I don't think so.
No. No.
So let's get into the controversy of it all, to any extent that we have not already, because we've been going for so long. Yeah, BJ, tell me what you've been hearing about this from people who have seen the movie.
All righty. So the first thing that I want to acknowledge off the bat is it surprises me 0% that this is a script that Darren Aronofsky was interested in. For those that don't know, Darren Aronofsky made like Requiem for a Dream and Black Swan and The Wrestler and Mother, which is a movie that I actually weirdly do love because it's weird as hell. But these are all stories that tend to be about people at their absolute lowest and most desperate moments. I also think that he presents things in a way that feels exploitive as a tool for empathy, where it doesn't always connect. It ends up being so much more about the sensationalism of like what they are doing to their bodies. Usually, you know, in the case of the wrestler, it's, you know, very physical. It's an like an older person who should not be in this physical condition, but is doing it anyway. Black Swan, it's the same way with ballerinas. We know how like constrictive their bodies can be. But I do want to acknowledge that he straight up stole the story for Black Swan. It is Just Perfect Blue by Satoshi Kon. It's an anime from 1997. And when I say he stole it, I don't just mean like, oh, the stories are eerily similar. He bought the rights to Perfect Blue because he wanted to do a one-to-one shot from that movie in Requiem for a Dream. So he owns the rights to Perfect Blue. Wow. So when Black Swan came out, it's like, oh, you really did just take this thing and make it. Okay, sure, sure, fine. You know, that's very, very frustrating. And The Whale reminds me a lot of The Wrestler, and this is where I confess that I am deeply embedded in the wrestling community. I have made my own feature film about professional wrestling and the examination of the blurred lines of reality. But for a lot of people who have no real knowledge of professional wrestling outside of like WWE, they see a movie like The Wrestler and they're like, this is such a human and empathetic look at the world and the people that exist in it. But for those of us who actually are in wrestling, we know that this is sensationalized, it's bullshit, it's exploitive, it is not accurate at all. And I feel that's what's happening with The Whale, is that people are seeing the story that they do not understand, that they can only observe as an observer, and they're believing it at face value, when those of us who are in fat communities or in fat bodies know that it's horseshit. And it's just very gross, because he, Aronofsky, loves using exploitation as an exercise of empathy, and that's not what's happening here. There's a reviewer from Vanity Fair named Richard Lawson who saw it at Venice, the Venice Film Festival, and wrote about it. And there's a quote that I wanted to cite because I think it's really poignant. But it said, "What is expressed instead is a kind of leering horror, a portrait of a man gone to catastrophic ruin so that we, in the audience, may tap into our nobler, higher minds and see the worthy human being beneath the frightful exterior." And he says this as a criticism of not that, oh, this is what the big message is, but as in, you thought you were being empathetic, but really, this is a horror show, and it's really rude.
Yes.
Because The Whale is obviously a stage play, but the way that you consume theater is entirely different than the way that you both consume and stage film. There will be close-ups of his body, fixated, isolated moments of his body, of the way that he eats. There will be a soundtrack that elicits an emotion that is indicating to the audience what we're supposed to feel in this moment, in ways that I am very, very worried about.
Yeah.
And the big conflict of it all is Brendan Fraser. And I think this is where things get extremely complicated.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are under the impression that Brendan Fraser fell out of the limelight because he got older, he lost a bit of his hair, and he lost his George of the Jungle physique. That is what a lot of people operate under believing. Mm-hmm. First things first, Brendan Fraser has never stopped acting. He has consistently been working since his heyday in the late 90s into the early 2000s. They just have not been leading male roles like The Mummy. He's been doing a lot of side roles, a lot of character work, which, again, we know how people value character work. But he's never stopped working. But the reason that he fell out of the limelight is because, unfortunately, Brendan Fraser was sexually assaulted by Philip Burke, the former president of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, who was still a member of the Hollywood Press Association after the allegations came out. He only was renounced of his membership after he sent an email to the entire HFPA claiming that Black Lives Matter is a racist hate movement. So that's what it took for him to get fired, not the fact that he sexually assaulted Brendan Fraser.
Fuck.
So because of this whole situation, there is now this massive you know, comeback, like, excitement people have that Brendan mm-hmm. Fraser is back in a leading role. I want nothing but the best for Brendan Fraser. I want him to succeed. I want him to be back in the limelight. He should never have had to go through what he went through. He should not have been blacklisted for speaking out about his assault. That is absolutely horrible. But the way that people have responded to his casting is either we cannot criticize the whale because by doing so, we are then hoping for the failure of Brendan Fraser, who doesn't deserve it. Not true. We can hold multiple truths at the same time.
Yeah.
But there's also a very weird infantilization of Brendan Fraser as somebody who is a fat person. He is not a 600-pound fat person, but he is a fat person. Right. Also somebody who has been devastatingly harmed and is now coming to the limelight. And now everyone is treating him like a precious small bean and thinking he needs protection. And it's very telling that when women get back to the limelight after their survivor of SA, it is viewed as, yes, this bad bitch, look at her, we're so proud of her, she's powerful, she's brave. But with Brendan Fraser, it's like, oh, he's a soft, squishy melon, we have to protect him at all costs. So that has stifled a lot of the very important and necessary conversations about the whale, because people are not prepared to be able to have the conversation that, yes, it is a good thing Brendan Fraser is getting this opportunity, but no, this is not the right project.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and we're even seeing it in the reviews that are coming out. There are a lot of people who are, even the ones that are trying really hard to appear like they are, you know, fat allies, where they'll say like, oh, but it's a really, really good performance above all else. Like, oh, I have mixed feelings about the content, but he's wonderful. And I don't doubt that he's wonderful. If anybody can bring a emotional and beautiful connection to this character, I do think somebody of Brendan Fraser's caliber could pull it off. I have obviously do not like that he's in a fat suit or that they're CGIing his body. I have that's an entirely different conversation of issues. I don't doubt he's going to be great, but the reality is his greatness is going to come at the expense of a marginalized community that is going to be ignored because of this comeback narrative, which in a weird way, I kind of think is a little bit of a PR tool. Like, I don't want to be too tinfoil hat about this, but the emphasis on like him crying at Venice when they're getting the standing ovation and the fact that that has just been like blasted on all of our social media feeds, it really feels like we're trying so hard to deflect from the rightful criticism that is going to be hurled at this movie.
Yep.
Yes. Do you think it'll be nominated for an Oscar?
I do think it's going to be nominated for an Oscar. Aronofsky's movies often are.
Do you think it'll win?
I want to say no, but I don't think that's going to, I think it's going to happen because I think they're going to want that story because the Academy loves that kind of story. But then the only thing that's making me think maybe not is the fact that Chadwick Boseman did not get the Oscar after he passed away and it went to Anthony Hopkins. I think that was 2 years ago now because it seemed like the entire night that's what they were leading towards and then it didn't happen and everyone's like, what the hell?
It's definitely possible Brendan Fraser would win, but the movie wouldn't.
Yes. And I think that will be what we're going to deal with. I think if anything, he will win an award for acting. Mm-hmm. The movie, I don't think will win.
Yeah.
I think Everything Everywhere All at Once is going to take that.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. There is much, much controversy here. And it's hard because people really don't like two things being true at once. And so when I say The Whale is a play that is very harmful to this marginalized group, people say, you're going to cancel Brendan Fraser now?
Right. No! Like, where did you get? That's a whole new sentence.
I know.
Hey, not the play. Thanks.
First of all, I wouldn't cancel anyone who even made the most egregiously fat phobic content. I would call attention to the fat phobia on display, but if they, you know, saw the error of their ways and like made something that affirmed fat people or that didn't have to do with fat people, then I would be fine with that in the future, you know. And I just wish we could stop thinking out of that frame of like bad people, also good people. Just
cancellation is like, there needs, we need to have new vocabulary about this, because cancellation is not actually a thing that's happening all that often.
Mm-hmm. Brendan Fraser was canceled, if anybody.
Oh, mm-hmm. No, for real. The thing is that the people who are canceled for speaking out against abuse.
Yes.
Are canceled for speaking out against mistreatment in general.
And that's like, always how it's been.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that is cancellation. That's blacklisting, whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, people who fuck up, they might lose some, you know, people who used to like them might lose some notoriety. But, like, generally nobody is, like, barred from entry into any, like, creative realm.
Especially not if they're already enormously successful. I mean, look at J.K. Rowling.
J.K. Rowling is still writing books. Roman Polanski is still making movies. Jared Leto is still getting cast in movies. Like, it's Dave Chappelle is still getting to tour around the country. Like,
yes.
Once you hit a certain fame threshold and money-making threshold, there is nothing that will stop the tide of your celebrity and your ability to make people money, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is sad. But
yep.
Yeah, so something like this, like criticizing something that actually has material effects and harm to a marginalized group, like that's not canceling. That's just let me help make you aware of this. And like,
And it's already bad. Like the conversations around it are also just really like they're triggering and traumatic because people who work in a lot of the entertainment industry, especially in the entertainment industry, they don't know how to have conversations about fatness or fat people. There have already been articles published that refer to his body as like Jabba the Hutt, which is very interesting and telling. And this is, you know, I'll add a little bit of levity here. I did write a piece when Book of Boba Fett came out because they introduced Jabba the Hutt having a female cousin and everyone just carries her around and she just gets to like be fat and worshipped and everyone's scared of her. And I was like, wow, what a dream. Love this. And I wrote an article that was kind of like making fun of like girl boss articles where it was like Jabba the Hutt's lady cousin is goals or whatever. And the amount of just hatred people threw at me because they thought I was being serious.
Oh my God.
I'm like, no, I am not actually aspiring to do. Calm down. Please go outside. A single molecule of fresh oxygen begging you to breathe it.
People just don't take, they take everything so literally. Everything, and they jump to conclusions on the internet. And like, I've been accused of doing that, and I probably do that too, and I'm sure it's just kind of a condition of being on the internet and how the internet is. But it is very easy when you don't have the nuance of people's expression or whatever, or they can't explain things to you, to take things super like on their face.
Mm-hmm. I think everything with the whale is, this is an ultimate example of intent versus impact. I genuinely don't think that anyone involved in this, as harsh and sarcastic as I was earlier, I genuinely don't think that anybody who was in the development of the play or the development of the movie sat down and was like, you know who I'm going to stick it to? Fat people. Let's poke and laugh at them. I genuinely don't think so. I think everybody was under the impression of, well, we've already told a lot of stories about people who slowly kill themselves with alcohol and drugs. Let's do it with food. Like, I think that's where it came from.
Also, it was very much a hot topic in those times. It was obesity epidemic, My 600-pound Life, The Biggest Loser, like all that stuff. And gawking at fat people was almost always for comedic effect or shock and horror and disgust.
Oh, we are at peak people of Walmart.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And so, like, giving them any bit of humanity was controversial and like shocking for its time and probably was some kind of step forward, but God, not like this.
And I think that you're right. And I think when it comes to how many awards this play was given, I think that's part of it. And the thing that is telling for me, and this is going to weirdly come full circle to something I made earlier, is a lot of people were like, how did this play get a GLAAD award? Because it's so like, you know, internalized homophobia. But
yeah,
we weren't having discussions about internalized homophobia in 2010. We were barely having discussions about like we were trying
about to get homophobia.
We were trying to get the right to get married and like have basic humanity at this point. Like we were not there yet as a culture. And so, you know, GLAAD does recognize small steps. And my proof for that being is that South Park has a GLAAD award.
That's fucking hilarious.
They got one for the first season for Big Gay Al's Big Gay Boat Ride. So like,
that is so funny.
And like in hindsight, that sounds just completely absurd. But when you look at the time period in which they came out, it does make sense. Like where we were at culturally.
Yeah.
We like to believe we were a lot more progressive than we were, and we were not.
We were so not. I was actually just thinking about this as I was reading the play, how in my, teen to adult life, the narratives around being queer have radically changed. Mm-hmm. Like when I was in, you know, pre-2010, it was, honestly, I would say pre-Glee for me because of how the age I was at that time, it was an insult. And it was something that you spoke of in hushed tones. And then, and it was something where it was like, oh, they have a partner. But I mean, at the same time, like my Hebrew school principal had a wife and like that was fine and normal. But like also the just gay was like kind of like a hushed tones bad word. And then like fatness, honestly, like once it became more accepted and I started to accept it, I started to be like, oh yeah, I've known a bunch of gay people my whole life. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But like there was just such a radical shift and we actually have come really far in the course of a decade.
Yeah. And I think that that's something that sometimes I think younger generations struggle to comprehend because it's like when you're trying to explain to somebody who lives in California what it's like to be caught in a snowstorm. Like they have no comprehension because it's impossible to explain that until you've experienced it. But we end up talking about these sort of subjects a lot on my podcast because teen movies are time capsules because they are not trying to be timeless. They're not trying to be something that can last forever. They're trying to strike what is cool right here in this second, here and now. And that tends to show the warts and all of culture with especially language. And I think that's also why Ellie says the R word so often because it's the early 2010s. We really hadn't had those conversations yet. We were getting there.
We were just starting, which is why Charlie says don't use it.
Right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's telling that she uses that and not like the F slur because we are in a post Hillary Duff don't call it gay PSA when this play is written. So homophobia has been solved. We're past it. And that's why.
Except for people who have to eat themselves to death because of it.
This is just telling me Hillary Duff needs to make a PSA about
fatphobia. She needs to make another one.
Please, Hillary. We're counting on you.
Please, Hillary. We need you.
Hillary, step up.
Oh my God.
We need your voice.
I was actually pretty shocked by the homophobia in this. Like, upon this reread, I was like, oh my God, I forgot. I knew they said bad stuff about fatness, but I forgot how bad stuff they said about being gay. Man, I mean, and it's one of those things too. I think it's a very similar thing because with fat people, the narrative is like tragedy. Mm-hmm. Emotional issues, the struggle, you know what I mean? And fat people often aren't even afforded that. And then I think similarly, like the LGBTQ issues you see, they're either like AIDS, sad, coming out, or they're like sassy, gay, funny friend, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think it's that similar thing where it's like it's a marginalized group and they can only be tragedy porn or comic relief.
Mm-hmm. Between the fat phobia, the homophobia, and the ableism in this play, it is just a hat trick of oppression.
The ableism really, like, threw me for a fucking loop in this one. Like, right? Which really, like, it always comes out when people are talking about larger fat people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, some larger fat people are disabled. And they, like, there's a lot of, like, you know, kind of intertwining of, like, fatness and disability. And, of course, like, you know, kind of characterizing fat people as like wanting or like willfully disabling themselves.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. why would you do that? And it's just odd. It's very fucking odd.
I mean, this basically whole play is predicated on the idea of doing this to yourself, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about somebody who has an eating disorder. It's not about somebody who has a medical condition. It's not about like any of that kind of thing. It's not about food deserts and access to fresh produce. Mm-hmm. It is about somebody willfully choosing consciously to eat themselves to death.
My body, my choice.
It is your body, your choice.
And what is so infuriating, like on top of all of it, is that we are supposed to see this as a humanizing and empathetic approach to fatness, whatever bullshit they want to tag on. Beauty's in the eye of the whatever, I don't care. No one at any moment in this entire play decides to treat the cause. They are fixated on the symptom. It is all about, we have to get you smaller, we have to get you better, we have to get you healthier, you're dying. Never once does someone go, hey, you know what, Charlie? You are not handling the loss of your partner well. We need to get you help psychologically. Let's talk about how you're feeling. Why are you feeling this way? Why are you eating in retaliation to your lover starving? Like, let's break this down and unpack this. No one ever does that with him. It's just purely, you look so fat. And it's like, what the shit?
And they all know where it's coming from. They all know that it's trauma. They all know what happened.
Yeah.
And all they say is, you fat fucking disgusting, like, lardo pig. Like, they don't say, you know, they don't say, like, I know life is hard and this is how you're coping.
And what's so fucked is that this is clearly supposed to be a parallel to, again, hoarders and addiction and substance abuse. Could you imagine watching a play that's about somebody with addiction issues and the entire time they were just like, you horrible, dirty, junkie, blah. Like, nobody does that. Like, that's not a thing that happens. So why the shit are you doing it here? We know why, but ugh.
And as much as I hate the food addiction, oh, they're addicted to food, it's out of their control, mm-hmm. you know, fatness is a psychological issue rhetoric, because that's such bullshit.
Yeah.
I think that, why can't we at least treat it like it is if you're going to go there? You know what I
mean? Exactly. Yeah. If that's the point you're trying to make, like, then make the
it's
point.
It's like, it's a choice or it's not a choice. Pick one. Mm-hmm. Pick a side. Mm-hmm.
And they can't. Mm-hmm. They don't do it. And it just turns into this awful, you know, victim blamey bullshit. And I want to set everything on fire. I want to be a fat kid who sets fires. Like, that's what I want.
Maybe I should write that. You know how, I don't know if you guys know Aziza Barnes, but she wrote this play Blacks as sort of an anti-girls, the TV show. So I'm like, maybe my fat kid sets things on fire is my anti-fat kids on fire.
Just let fat kids have justified rage. That sounds
perfect.
Fat kids
start fires.
Just let fat kids start fires.
Oh my God.
I feel like we now figured out your next, like, one person performance, like,
yeah, 100%. Well, thank you guys both so much for being here. This was wonderful. Does anyone have any closing thoughts on The Whale?
I'm not excited to see it in a theater of my peers where I am going to stewing the entire time. And I know that there's going to be some lady or some, like, well-meaning woke guy sitting next to me just enraptured and in tears while I, the actual fat person, likely in an uncomfortable seat because a lot of the theaters they rent out for critics are older and not comfortable, just being miserable with the entire experience.
I don't think I'm going to see it if I can avoid it personally. Because I will tell you, when I was reading this play, I had, like, not one, not two, not three, not four, probably around five moments where I was like, no, closed my laptop and fucking left my room. I was like, no, nope, this is not real.
I'm at a crossroads. I'm in a dilemma because I'm like, should I see it for content? I feel like yes, but then should I see it for giving them money? No.
Yeah, I'm not going to have to pay for it when I see it, which is the privilege that I have for the line of work that I am
fair.
In.
Fair.
I am hoping more than anything that I'll be able to have it as a screener so I can watch it in the comfort of my home and scream at the screen as necessary. I have a feeling I'm not going to be able to have that, which I'm not thrilled about, but we will find out. But it is one of those things where I need to see how it's staged with my own eyes. I can make as many assumptions as possible about what I think Aronofsky is going to do. A thing I've heard from multiple critics who have seen it is that the soundtrack and the score is particularly offensive. Not in the sense of like following somebody with a tuba around like that horrible vine. Like, not like that. I know every fat person knows which vine I'm talking about. Yes. Too.
I do not know Vine because I didn't have an iPhone when it was.
Okay, so out. There is a very famous vine because it was so funny where a kid with either a tuba or a sousaphone is following a fat man in a grocery store playing bum ba-da-da-da-dum, ba-dum, and he turns around and screams at him and is like, stop it. And that was really popular on Vine.
That's so fucked up.
Hilarity ensues.
And that was where we were at in 2011.
Correct. Exactly. Yeah. Like, that's what we were doing. That we thought that was hilarious then. So that was, you know, the royal we. But so it's not quite that, but they have said that, like, he will, like, when he eats chicken, the score is basically presenting it like he's eating a bomb. Like,
he's like doing cannibalism. Leave it to Yellow Jackets, bitch.
Yeah,
like,
for real. It's very much presented like, oh no,
like he's eating music.
Something. Like,
oh.
That's,
oh my God.
That's okay. The takeaway is that it's very dramatic and very like, like, okay, he's eating poison.
I have to see it with my own eyes. I know that's the decision I'm going to make, and yet it's going to harm me so deeply.
I swear to God, that whole thing, I'm just like, all right, guess nobody should eat. That makes sense.
Right. Because our bodies will go, oh, you're hungry? Good news. You have bat wings under your arms. I'll just eat that right up.
Good news.
Cool. Yep. Love it. Thanks, body, for knowing that intuitively.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Good Lord. Okay, well, I think this is a good place to leave it since we have been talking for 2.5 hours now.
Beautiful.
The episode won't be 2.5 hours, so
We did it.
It might be two.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much for your time. I know this is like an hour and a half longer than I said it was going to go, but you know what? We got to it all. We discussed. Mm-hmm. We discussed.
We did it.
And we also, I skimmed the play in real time to read the synopsis because it's a play and there's no detailed synopsis like a movie.
So. Yeah.
That's why it took so long. But anyway, thank you again. It's been wonderful. I wish you all the most mental wellness before, after, or never seeing the whale.
Yeah. Turn on the muted terms on Twitter as soon as possible.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yep.
No, I have to know.
I know. I'm the same way. I'm like, oh, I gotta know. I gotta know with my eyes. I need to be able to speak with authority.
So, obviously, reading Twitter is the best way to be able to speak with authority on
Of course,
things.
Yes. That's how we learn. We read Twitter and we watch 1-minute videos on TikTok.
Yes.
Word. All right. Have an amazing night, everybody. Thank you for listening. Let me know your thoughts on The Whale, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to More Than Tracy Turnblad. If you liked it, hit subscribe and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. This is our first episode back, and episodes will be dropping every other Monday going forward. If you'd like bonus episodes for those off weeks, come find us on Patreon at patreon.com/morethantracyt. where you can get bonus episodes and other special content. I've just lowered the prices on the top 3 tiers, so come check it out. Link is in the description. As always, be sure to follow us on social media at MoreThanTracyT on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and you can find more information at MoreThanTracyTurnblad.com.